All right, so here we are, another week. See, make sure I'm looking for glasses all the time. I don't know anybody else. Have you hit this part in your life? If you haven't, you're young. And I'm like searching for glasses all the time. And I'm like, what have I got up here? Where is this? You know, I got glasses all over the place. But this morning, we're continuing our journey in Revelation and our examination of the seven churches to which this message was originally delivered. It is vitally important as we begin, as we embark on this, because we're still kind of early in the stages of this. It is vitally important that you understand the context in which this was delivered, how this was originally shared, because we kind of need to stay tied to that and connected to that before we start walking into what some people would think is all this crazy imagery and symbolism, because it's easy, like I said before, it's easy to get lost in that. It's easy to get enamored with all these crazy sounding details, and then you actually lose the very message of which this is about. And so it's incredibly important that we don't, like last week we began looking at these churches, this week we'll continue. You've got to remember that this was a revelation, this was from Christ and about Christ given to the Apostle John. And John has a direct connection to these churches. In fact, we shared last week that he lived in one of the areas at Ephesus, right? But these are churches that are all in a particular region. And there's great significance to this. And so kind of when this revelation, when this message was delivered, everybody got it. It was almost like a circuit letter. When this went out, it was sent and it went to every one of these churches. So even though there's a portion in there that says, write this letter to the church of, guess what? Everybody got to read what your problem was. These weren't individually just sent to this church, this church, this church, this church, so they only got to see your problem, right? This was sent out, and it went from church to church to church to church to church. And so they could all see what their problem was, but they also got to see what everybody else's problem was. It was kind of an exposing thing, wasn't it? And then they had to dive into this, and like I told you before, usually this was digested, not piecemeal or not like little teeny chapters or verses, but usually when this was received, it was received in its entirety. Right? Now, we're going to break it down and spend many, many weeks, but they would have sat and listened to this in its entirety. And, that might be a good challenge for you if you've got a day that you're feeling down, or you've got a day where you're not working and you've got some time on your hands and you want to read. Maybe you could just take that on as a challenge and read the entire book of Revelation in one setting. It would be a challenge, right? And at the end of it, you explain it. Okay? So I'm sure these guys were listening to this in its entirety and going, "Ooh." Right? So there's a lot in there. But it's important that we don't forget the fact that this was a revelation given. It was a message to the churches, seven churches, divine completion, a complete revelation to a complete representation of the church. So, it was sent to specific churches in a specific time in specific settings. So while there is a message for you and I today, okay, Revelation is not just about then and not just about those churches. There is a message for you and I in here. There is something that you and I can apply. We can't do it apart from or separating or neglecting its original setting and the original context in which it's delivered. Okay, so it's important for us to get a sense of that. And last week, I hoped I was able to tap into a little of that and share with you how specific, how amazingly specific it was that when one of these messages were sent to a church and it was saying, deliver this to this particular church or deliver this to this particular church, that it was amazing the accuracy. You know, there was these little messages in there and the particular need of that congregation or that body reflected also the city and its culture in which it was found. That continues today. But this week, we've only got three churches versus four churches last week. And so a little less to bite off, a little more time we can spend on these churches. In fact, I'm going to spend more time on two of them in particular. So all of these churches are situated in a place called Asia Minor. We know that as what today? Modern day Turkey. Exactly. And this was during that time frame which this was delivered. It was one of the most pagan areas of the ancient, but not primitive. When I say pagan, sometimes we have a tendency to think, and we're equipped or synonymously put together, that pagan means some kind of primitive. Now, this was a very sophisticated region. They were very advanced, okay? Very sophisticated region, but yet very pagan. And yet, that being the culture and that being the condition of this whole region, this area, Asia Minor was where the message of the gospel and the Church of Jesus Christ grew the fastest. In the most difficult setting, in one of the most crazy scenarios, and different things that were going on, a very, very, very pagan culture, and yet, that's where the gospel message and the church grew the fastest. It's kind of ironic to think about. So, before we jump into this any further, got a couple questions. Right? You didn't see that coming. That was going to be new for you. So, couple of questions for you to ponder as we journey into chapter 3 today. And I didn't put you in there. I changed it and put we, right? And that wasn't just to make you feel better, you know, because some of you leave thinking, man, he's always talking about me. Well, quit doing that crap and I won't be. I'm just doing what the word says. When it smacks you, that's your fault, not mine, right? We don't change the word to fit our lives. We change our lives to fit the word, right? Period. Period. So if you don't line up with the word, you're wrong. It's that simple. Was that clear? Okay. Sometimes I'm not sure if I'm clear enough on things. You know, I don't want it to be cloudy, murky. Okay, so here's the questions. Ready? Some of you, this might actually be applicable right at this second. I don't know. Are we asleep? This is the actual question. Are we asleep? I'll expound on that. In what ways have we, okay, because we're in this together. In what ways have we become careless or apathetic in our walk with Christ? Well, there's a question for you to think of, right? It's kind of what I meant when I say, are we asleep? Right? In what ways have we become careless or apathetic in our walk with Christ? That's one of the questions I want you to ponder this morning. Here's the next one. All right? What's our temperature? 98.6. Normal. Well, normal is a relative term. I'm not finding normal. I think normal has disappeared, evaporated, and all that. Right. What used to be normal, there's a new normal. And so what is our temperature today? So let me expound on that a little bit. Using the metaphor of water, how could we or how would we characterize our effect on the world around us? Hot? Cold? Or lukewarm? Okay, let me say that again. Because I know it's using metaphor. Some of you are concrete, right? And so this is a stretch for you. I'm trying to get you to imagine something. So using the metaphor of water, right? How would we characterize our effect on the world around us? Hot, cold, or lukewarm? I think Clem thinks it's lukewarm. So let's take a look. There's a couple different cities that we're going to check into this morning. You'll see them in your programs. We'll get to the passage in a minute. But there's three churches, there's three cities, three cultures that are reflected in these three cities. That this letter is addressing. And the first one is a place called Sardis. Sardis. And I want to tell you a little bit about the city before we jump into the scripture. Now, Sardis, one of the things about Sardis you need to know first and foremost is that Sardis was an incredibly wealthy city. An incredibly wealthy city full of sophisticated paganism, right? Not just your garden variety, but sophisticated paganism. There was all kinds of different worship going on in this place and all kinds of temples and just a lot of stuff that are happening, right? Very sophisticated. In fact, crazy enough, found in Sardis was the largest synagogue ever discovered in the ancient world. The largest synagogue ever discovered in the ancient world was found in Sardis. It could seat over 1,000 people. Right? Major, major synagogue, which is kind of bizarre if you think about it, but not if you really think about it. See, God kind of goes ahead. I don't know if you thought that God is just like this random God. God may appear random very much in our lives, but he is very painstakingly and very precise working things out, and he goes ahead of us a lot of times. See, this would be a place, as I've already mentioned earlier, that this region, Asia Minor, which we call Turkey, would be a place where the gospel message would grow and the church would grow the fastest. You know what was one of the major things that helped it grow so fast? Was the fact that years before, when different empires had come in and dispersed the Jews, huge amounts of Jews, large community, Jewish communities, were driven to that area. There was a large Jewish presence all over Asia Minor in each of these cities. And that large Jewish presence in each of these cities made it prime, ready to hear the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ, because they already had the background. They already knew the Old Testament. They already knew there was a Messiah to come. They already had all of that. It wasn't like going from Jump Street from zero where nobody has a clue. These guys had a lot going on. And so when the message of Jesus Christ arrived, many were ripe and ready for it. That had a lot to do with it. But anyway, largest synagogue in the ancient world found in Sardis. But the thing is, among the ruins of Sardis, there's some very, very thought-provoking things that you discover among the ruins of Sardis, right? There are all kinds of, there's actually a shopping mall. There's a shopping mall, you know, in Sardis. Ancient shopping mall, where there would be like little, you know, different shops along the street. And what's interesting about some of them, there are pagan symbols and there are Christian symbols and Jewish symbols all over the place, right? There are menorahs stamped into stones all over the place, very Jewish symbol. There are crosses stamped in, Christian symbol, but not the early one. A lot of us don't realize that. Most of the symbols of the Christian world, the early symbol was the fish. That was a symbol of Jesus. And so that's found all over the stonework. But what was really crazy is some of these places are actually pagan stones with all kinds of pagan stuff written on them, but scratched over top of them are these Christian symbols. Like, it's almost like they were taking this pagan stuff and redeeming it to the glory of God or to the glory of Christ. A couple other things. There was... You guys have heard, well, I mean, today we kind of think about it differently. You know, some of you guys go to the gym, right? You've heard of a gymnasium, right? Well, they had a gymnasium too, but it wasn't quite what we think of it is. We think of the gym where you just go and work out primarily. But the gymnasium in that culture, that was one thing. A lot of people trained and did different things, right? But the gymnasium was also very much an educational facility. And there was an extremely large gymnasium, or you could almost think university, in Sardis. And so this was big Greek culture, right? They would train for all the athletic games, and everybody trained in the nude, right? That's exciting, right? That's what they thought, right? Because the human body, they thought, was like the pinnacle of perfection. And the human mind was the pinnacle of perfection, very much this Hellenistic approach. And so that took place. And in the middle of where all of that was going on, in the middle of this university where this Hellenistic culture was being passed on through the university, that's where the largest synagogue was found. In the middle of that university. That's kind of a weird thing. Not sure what to think about that. Either they were having an incredible impact on their culture and they were in the midst of it and accepted, or they were maybe doing something else. There was also this temple, right? Because they had all these different gods and pagan gods that they worshiped. And there's another crazy thing in the ruins of Sardis. In the midst of a temple to Artemis, there's a church. In the temple. I mean, maybe the church had been so amazing that they had come and they were beginning to impact their culture, or maybe something else was going on. At one time, the king in Sardis was considered the wealthiest man in the world. We always think of Solomon, right? Richest guy, wisest guy. But at one time, the king in Sardis was considered the wealthiest man in the world. The city had a crazy history, though. It had been conquered two different times. The city had been conquered two different times, 550 BC, 200 BC. But here was the thing. It wasn't by conventional warfare. It wasn't like they were battling it out, right? There were people that laid siege to it. But the way that this city was conquered each time was due to carelessness. Due to carelessness. Right? There was a whole army that was lined up trying to siege this place, couldn't overtake them. And one soldier happened to watch this dude over the wall. I don't know if he was making faces at people, blah, whatever he was doing. And he drops his helmet. It's like, oh, crap. But this soldier kept watching. And he saw this guy lower himself down, retrieve his helmet, and go back up. And he realized, there's either a secret pathway or there's a lapse in their defense. And it was through that was taken advantage of. It was exploited, and they conquered the city. That happened two times. They didn't learn from the first one. 250 years later, the city was conquered again in almost the exact same circumstances. So this was a city that knew what it was like, that if you didn't remain vigilant and you got careless, you would end up conquered. That was their history. That's who they were. So, lack of vigilance ended up impacting them. So if you open up your programs, it'll be on the screen as well. Take a look at this passage as we open up. Revelation chapter 3, verse 1, beginning of this third chapter, says this. Write this letter to the angel, the messenger of the church in Sardis. This is the message from the one who has a sevenfold spirit, or the complete spirit of God, and the seven stars. Who are they? The seven messengers, right? We've already learned this. Usually the greeting stopped there, but he just charged right into this thing. I know all the things you do. So it seems like they did a lot. I know all the things you do, and that you have a reputation for being alive. But newsflash, you are dead. That's a greeting card, right? All right? Open it up. Happy birthday to you. You're alive. No, you're dead. I don't know. I mean, you know, this is kind of an abrupt thing. Here's one of the things in this pattern. I talked about this pattern started last week, that there's always this identification, that Christ identifies himself in some format or another, like this one, sevenfold spirit, holds the seven stars, he's identifying himself, and then he usually affirms them. He tells them, oh, here's the things that you're doing well, here's the thing that you're good at, and then there's a correction, but here's the things you stink at, so you need to work on, and then there's a motivation. So if you get this straightened out, if you do well, I will promise you this. That's kind of a pattern that goes through this. We reach Sardis, and guess what? No affirmation at all. There's nothing that says you were doing, no, saying, I know all the things you do. I know of your busyness. Okay, this is a message to the church. To the church. I know of your busyness. I don't know. I know of your programs. That you have a reputation for being alive. Maybe it's loud. Maybe it's lively. I don't know. But you're dead. Wow, this is coming from Jesus. Did you know that? This is coming from Christ through John to the messenger to be shared with the church. I mean, Jesus could have had a nicer way of putting that, couldn't he? Man, he's not as nice a guy as we thought. See, here's the thing about the church. Let me read this. I know all the things you do and that you have a reputation for being alive, but you are dead. Wake up. This is what he's saying to Sardis. Wake up. Strengthen what little remains, for even what is left is almost dead. I find that your actions do not meet the requirements of my God. Go back to what you heard and believed at first. Hold to it firmly. Repent and turn to me again. If you don't wake up, I will come to you suddenly, as unexpected as a thief, or as a stealthy army finding a lapse in your defense, you could say. They got the message. See, he wasn't being random. These messages were very specific. And the people that would have been receiving them in their city and in their context, knowing their history, they'd have gone, ooh, that kind of hurt. He's talking about us. Right? It's like somebody, if they really know your family, and they could throw out something generally, and to everybody else it sounds like, oh, okay. But you're going, that kind of hurt. If you don't wake up, I will come to you suddenly as unexpected as a thief. Yet there are some in the church in Sardis who have not soiled their clothes with evil. Here's the deal about the church in Sardis. They had gotten comfortable, folks. They had gotten comfortable, and through their comfort, they had been lulled to sleep. It was a church that grew dramatically in the beginning, and they were having an impact. But then all of a sudden, they got comfortable in the context of their culture. And the next thing you know, it didn't even bother them anymore. Heck, we could put the synagogue right in the gymnasium. That stuff, even though it's an affront to God, you know, we're trying to be tolerant. Well, I mean, even though, you know, God hates idolatry, and idolatry is adultery to God, we'll put our church in the corner of the temple. I mean, you know, that was written a long time ago. I mean, you know, things have changed. We have to change with the times. Soiled clothing speaks of impurity. They soiled their clothing. They're no longer pure. They've soiled their clothing with evil. I want to tell you something. I was reading and I came across a quote. Because the church, again, this is a message to this church, but wow, is this not a message that the church has needed throughout the centuries? Because throughout the centuries, the church has been lulled to sleep. Again and again. I don't know if we realize this. Think about all of the Christians in Germany during World War II. What did they do? Apparently nothing. I'll read you a quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I don't know if you know who he is. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a pastor, World War II, and throughout this whole thing. He was killed, he was assassinated, like in the last hours, not just last days, last hours of the war. As the occupation, as the people were being freed from occupation and the word was coming that the troops were coming, they began to execute all the prisoners they had. He was a prisoner because he stood up against the Nazi regime. Here's what he says. The failure of German Christians to resist the Nazi rise to power, not during it, the rise to power, stemmed from their lack of moral clarity. If the church doesn't know what's right or what's wrong, think about it. Who's going to carry the standard? The failure of German Christians to resist the Nazi rise to power stemmed from their lack of moral clarity. The only people who can stand in such situations are those whose standard is not reason or conscience, but God and His Word. That's Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So can we sleep? Can the church be lulled to sleep when it gets incredibly comfortable in the context of its culture? Hmm. But we'll continue on Revelation 3, 5, because there is good news in every one of these, right? So Revelation 3, 5, he says to them this, though. All who are victorious, all who don't fade to this, because he says in there, let's see, there was a few, yet there are some in the church of Sardis who have not soiled their clothes with evil. They will walk with me in white, for they are worthy. So there's some, there's a remnant. Not everybody, but the majority of the church in Sardis had given over to the evil, but there was few. And so he said, all who are victorious will be clothed in white, will be made pure. I will never, here's getting ready to be a disturbing thing for some of you, especially if you got a Baptist background. I will never erase their names from the book of life. Folks, when something like that's mentioned, it means that there's an actual possibility that your name can be erased from the book of life. And you need to just swallow that, whether you like it or not. In fact, today what's being taught in most churches of a Reformed nature or Baptist background is not even what John Calvin himself taught. And that's the guy who they refer to. See, both Arminians and Calvinists both agree on one thing, even if they define getting there differently. They both agree that those who refuse or do not persevere to the end will be lost. Even the Calvinists believe that, true Calvinists. Now, we can argue about who, well, they weren't saved or they were saved. You know, we can get into all that. All I got to tell you is if they ain't at the end, game over. But I will announce before my Father and his angels that they are mine. Makes you wonder about the nominal Christians that we have living in our world today that are depending on a past profession of faith to ensure their salvation. We talked about assurance weeks ago. What are we basing our insurance on? Are you basing it on the snot fest you had 25 years ago? You better base your assurance on one thing, and that is the blood of Christ and the present reality of it in your life. Don't tell me about what happened 25 years ago. Tell me about what Christ is to you 25 seconds ago. Or I don't want to hear it. Well, that's not very nice. Too bad. So, anyway, next city, moving on. Philadelphia. Well, we all know about Philadelphia, right? Some of us have been there. Not that Philadelphia, right? City of brotherly love, which I've been to Philadelphia. That's never been my experience. So, I don't know. Maybe somebody experienced it somewhere along the line. Hasn't been mine, per se. But here's the thing. They were a neighboring city. They had a very similar setting, very similar things that they were dealing with. But this was the younger of the churches. So it makes you kind of wonder, beg, because guess what? This church doesn't receive any correction. No correction. They're not messing up at all. They're doing it right. And they're one of the younger churches. Kind of makes you wonder, how long does it take for a church to go awry? 10 years? 20 years? How long does it take before a church becomes an organization and fails to be an organism, a living, breathing organism, a body, a community of Christ? See, all of these churches in Revelation of these seven churches, all these churches were well-established churches, and yet they were experiencing some difficult things. Philadelphia was the younger of the churches, and it seemed to be holding together, doing well. So it's almost like, you know what, we can get so far into this that we begin to lose ourselves, we begin to forget why we started this to begin with, or what meant, what mattered and what didn't, what doesn't. Revelation chapter 3, verse 7 says this, "Write this letter to the angel of the church in Philadelphia. This is the message from the one," another introduction, "who is holy and true, the one who has the key of David." Key of David, authority, right? Authority and power. Key of David would be like who has the keys to the kingdom and who can open up and who lets who in and all that kind of stuff. What he opens, no one can close. What he closes, no one can open. Right? And in other translations, you've got the door in there. He talks about doors that he opens, no one can close. The door he closes, no one can open. So there's this door thing. That's going to come up later. That's going to be important. But he starts to use and incorporate this door metaphor. Right? Philadelphia receives no correction. This is what he goes on to say. I know all the things you do. He kind of started that out with the other guys. But he continues this. And I have opened a door for you that no one can close. You have little strength. You're not very big. Yet you obeyed my word and did not deny me. Look, I will force those who belong to Satan's synagogue, those liars who say they are Jews but are not. Remember that? We talked about that last week, the Satan's synagogue, and it were those who were Gentiles who were pretending to be Jewish, and then they were incorporating kind of a quasi thing in there, and it was like, this wasn't like a thing against the Jews in the synagogue, it was against Satan's synagogue, which was this quasi messed up craziness. Okay? That's what he's referring to again. Look, I will force those who belong to Satan's synagogue, those liars who say they are Jews but are not, to come and bow down at your feet. They will acknowledge that you are the ones I love, or that yours is the true way. Because you have obeyed my command to persevere, I will protect you from the great time of testing that will come upon the whole world to test those who belong to this world. I am coming soon. Hold on to what you have so that no one will take away your crown. So that no one will take away your crown. They were small, but they were faithful. See, it's not about how large we are. I mean, yeah, we want more people to come. We want more people. We want to grow. We want to build relationships. But the question is, are we faithful? That's what stood out. That's why they received nothing but affirmation. They were this huge, powerful church, but they were a collection of people who were incredibly faithful. And they were patiently enduring the things that were coming against them. It seems sometimes, I don't know if you've experienced this in your life, but it's sometimes in my most weakest situations or my most weak times is when I kind of experienced the most dependence on God. Anybody ever experienced that one? Like when you got it all together and you can answer this and you can fix this and you can figure that out, you know what's real easy? Just got to leave God out. I got it. I got this. Right? But it's when all of a sudden we realize, I ain't got this. I am in trouble. I am over my head. I do not know. I haven't got a clue. And all of a sudden, we bust out the prayers. Isn't it interesting? Right? That's when our prayer life gets invigorated. It's like, oh, Lord, help me. Right? But when things are good, oh, I got it, Lord. It's all right. I'll call on you when I need you. Right? We want Jesus, but we want Jesus back over there. But when things go crap, we want Jesus front and center. You know? We want Jesus over there until things get back. Oh, Jesus, I need you. Yeah, talk to him. All right? That's how we kind of do things. And I got a sense that, you know, this small church, this Philadelphia church who were remaining faithful, they weren't big and powerful. No, they were weak in some ways. But that's what made them powerful, because they were trusting in, they were depending on God. That's powerful stuff. Because his power is way beyond anything we can ever muster. And then he says to them, and here this has been used a lot of times, this one verse in here, and he says, I will protect you from the great time of testing that will come upon the whole world to test those who belong to this world. And again, because some people have gotten enamored in the details and left the message of what this is about, they start going, oh, see, that's rapture stuff right there. See, we're not going to be around for that. We don't have to deal with any of that because we don't have suffering. That's not what we do. Right? Christians don't suffer, man. We're getting all out of here. We're pushing the button. We're ejecting. We're out of here before all that stuff happens. Really? Somebody forgot to tell all the other people that were following Jesus in the Bible. People in the Old Testament, right? Go to Hebrews chapter 11. Read that chapter. Doesn't sound like a whole lot of eject buttons going on there. It sounds more to me like this protection does not necessarily mean removal. I mean, but that's what we want. I mean, I get it. When we have problems, we want God to remove us from our problems, right? Or we want God to remove our problems from us. I like that. I pray that. I'll be honest. That's always kind of like the first thing. Hey, God, can you like take this thing away? Because that would be cool. And then he goes, no, walk through it. That sucks. Okay, let me try something again. Okay, God, if I'm really good. See, we go into all kinds of craziness because God's saying, look, I will protect you in it. I will walk with you through it. His protection doesn't always automatically equate to removal. In fact, it's when we walk through some of the most difficult times that guess what happens? We grow. Our faith actually grows when we go through difficult situations. I know that's not the popular line that nobody wants to get in. Anyway, so it continues on. Revelation chapter 3, verse 12. This is where we've got good news on this. So all who are victorious will become pillars in the temple of my God, and they will never have to leave it. And I will write on them the name of my God, and they will be citizens in the city of my God, the new Jerusalem that comes down from heaven from my God, and I will also write on them my new name. Wow. So if you are victorious, what does it mean to be victorious? It means, will you listen? Oh, there's a thing I've been leaving out. I don't know if there's another part you hear repeated over and over and over again in Revelation. I left it out to see if you were listening. There's a phrase that gets repeated over and over again after every one of these warnings. Anybody know what that is? Why? Oh, to them who have ears, or he who has ears to hear, let them listen. So guess who the victorious people are? The people who listen. And listen is not hearing. Listening is not hearing. There's a difference. You may hear the sound of my voice right now. That does not mean you're listening. Those who are victorious are those who hear the sound of God's voice and obey the warning he gives them. That's listening. Right? And the people who are victorious in Philadelphia, he says, man, I'm going to make you permanent fixtures in God's temple and give you some new tattoos. Right? Y'all didn't see? It's right there, right? Okay, that's loose, but I was just throwing it in there, right? He's going to write his name and all kinds of stuff, so maybe not. Maybe embroidering on some kind of gown, but I think the tattoo thing would be better. Okay, final church, final city for today. We call it Laodicea. That's what everybody uses, Laodicea. Revelation. Well, here's something that I find interesting. I don't know how many people are here today. I don't even know if anyone is here today. Maybe. I'll take a risk on this. We'll see. Yeah, there's a few maybe. How many people here this morning were here for the very first Sunday morning service of Real Life Chapel? Two. Three. Do I hear four? Five. Six. Seven. Eight. Nine. Chris wasn't here, was he? Oh, Chris was here. Okay, just checking. Didn't know. So, 10 people. Okay, so here's the deal. I don't know if you recall this, and for the bulk of you who weren't here, you wouldn't. This is the passage we started Real Life Chapel with. This was our very first Sunday morning service, the very first message on a Sunday morning of Real Life Chapel was out of Revelation chapter 3. I think it was verses 14 through 21. Yeah. See, here's the thing. You know, like last week I asked you a couple questions. I don't know if you even remember the questions I asked you last week. One of them I said was, what would it look like today if God was to dictate a revelation, a letter, and John was to give a letter today to the churches in Easton? Okay, so you got to kind of picture this. We got to fill in the blanks. We could just pick seven churches, right? We could say, okay, this is Saint Evan, Apostle Evan's letter to the churches in Easton. He's just kind of got that elderly apostolic look right now. Anyway, the message to the churches and say, this letter is to Oasis Covenant. This letter is to Talbot Bible. This letter is to St. Mark's. This letter is to First Baptist. This letter is to Real Life Chapel. What would that look like? What would be the message? What would be the affirmations? What would be the corrections? So, I mean, I think as I'm saying this today, I hope that you would kind of almost overlay that and go, wow, write this letter to Real Life Chapel. And then read it. And if the shoe fits, we need to wear it. And maybe learn from it. And listen. And change. Laodicea. City of 120,000 people. Right? Again, we got to kind of wrap our heads around this. A lot of times we get stuff in the Word and we think, oh, it's all these little villages and they got a couple donkeys tied up to these little buildings and this and that. It's 120,000 people in this place. That's a major city. Now, 10 miles west of a place called Colossa, 6 miles south of a place called Hierapolis, two other important cities in that region. Now, here's the thing you need to know about Laodicea. It was an incredibly wealthy place, great resources, and they were very self-sufficient. Very self-sufficient. In fact, there had been a major earthquake in that whole region and it affected several of the churches. And there was this federal assistance program. And so when the emperor came around and started saying, look, oh man, the damages here are crazy, right? Let me help you out. We're going to give you some of these funds to take care of rebuilding. You know what the people in Laodicea, Laodicea, you know what they did? They said, oh, please, we don't need that. We got it. Wow, would anybody do that today? Turn down government assistance? What? Well, we're going to help you rebuild your city. Don't worry about it. We got it under control. We don't need the government money. We're wealthy. We got it. That's what they said. We don't need any of the money. We got it, man. We'll rebuild it. We got the money. Very wealthy place. Great resources. Self-sufficient. Here's what was going on. It was a wealthy banking center. A wealthy banking center for the entire region. So gold and silver and all that stuff was exchanged in Laodicea. That's where things were exchanged. It's money markets, right? Not only was it a great banking center, it was a textile center. And they specialized in something. They specialized in black wool. Black wool. Right? Because of the animals they raised in the region. Black wool, that's what they were known for. Big textile center. And then there was also a medical production facility in Laodicea that you know what they made? And they shipped it all over the place. Eye salve. Salve to help people when they were having problems with their eyesight. I mean, this is what this place is known for. So they're a banking center. They're a textile center. They're a medical production facility. That's what this place, very wealthy. But you know what they didn't have? They had a horrible water system. Horrible. Absolutely horrible. They had to pipe in water because of where they were located. They piped in water for miles in pipes. Terracotta type style pipes. They piped in the water. Here was the problem. Why I mentioned those other two places? Because it's very significant. See, the people in Laodicea, they had two things going on. They could look, right, north of them. They could look north of them, and they saw these white cliffs You can go online. You can Google Earth this. It's there. You can see these white cliffs from miles away. You can see these bright white cliffs. Really cool looking. But what was it about? When you got closer to them, you could see that these white cliffs are an effect of the hot springs, the hot natural springs that are in Hierapolis. And it's this hot natural mineral water that spills out. And as it spills down and is starting to cool, it creates these sediments, right? And it's all white going down these cliffs. But people, still today, but back then majorly, people traveled for miles to come to Hierapolis because of the healing that they could receive by going and sitting in the hot baths, the hot springs in Hierapolis. It was known throughout the region. People traveled around. Man, if you had something going on, right, little aches, little pains, things clicking, right, things not clicking that are supposed to be clicking, all kinds of stuff, right? You would go sit in these seriously hot baths with these mineral qualities, and it relieved people's aches and pains. There was healing. They knew that. So that's going on up north of them. But west of Laodicea, west of Laodicea was a place called Colossa. And you know what they were known for? See, they were at the base of a mountain called Mount Cadmus. And Mount Cadmus is tall enough in elevation that most of the time it's snow-capped. Elevation matters. I don't know if you know that. You could go like in Colorado Springs. We could be out there in August and we can go have a snowball fight. We just got to go up. But see, what happens to all of that snow? It melts. And it goes down. And it flows into streams and creeks and rivers. And guess what? It's cold. Have we got anybody that went to Colorado that can testify that snow melt water is cold? Very cold. Energizingly cold, right? It either wake you up or kill you, one or the other, right? Sometimes it does both. It kills you, but then it revives you, so it's okay. It's cold. And the water from Colossae was cold. Mountain water from snow melt. So they, man, people would travel to Colossae. They probably, you know, I don't know this for sure, but I mean, like I know they do today, somebody's, you know, bottling water and they're selling it to us. You know, we're buying this bottle of water from whatever place and it just came out of Uncle Joe's faucet somewhere. But, you know, they had water that people would come for miles and they would bottle it up because it was so clear, clean, refreshing, cold, man. This is where you came to get refreshed. This came where you came to get reinvigorated. Man, the cold water of Colossae, people knew that. But see, here's the problem. Where they were situated, Laodicea, where they were situated geographically, topography-wise, both of those types of water kind of flowed toward them. But guess what? They met before they got to them. And when you take really, really, really hot mineral water and mix it with really, really cold snow melt, you end up with lukewarm blah. And so the water in, you know, in Laodicea, when people came there, it was like, man, we got great restaurants, got this and that. Don't drink the water. Right? That was like part of their visitor information. Don't drink the water. Get the bottled water while you're here because that's nasty stuff. Right? That's part of who they were. So, Revelation chapter 3, verse 14 says this. Write this letter to the angel, the messenger of the church in Laodicea. This is the message from the one who is the Amen, right? Amen means agreeable final word. The faithful and true witness, the beginning of God's new creation. So here's his message to the church in Laodicea. We could say this is his message to Real Life Chapel. And if it fits, then we need to wear it and change from it. Well, we could have said this for Sardis. So, I know all the things you do, that you are neither hot nor cold. I wish that you were one or the other, but since you are like lukewarm water, neither hot nor cold, I will spit you out of my mouth. You make me puke, that's what he's saying. You say I am rich. Now think about Laodicea, what I told you about the city. I have everything I want. I don't need a thing. and you don't realize that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. Wow, poor, blind, and naked. That's pretty tough to swallow when you're a banking center, a textile center, and you produce eye salve. That's pretty specific. So I advise you to buy gold for me. Now, this is what God's saying to them. Gold that has been purified by fire. Then you will be rich. Also buy white garments for me. That probably got under their skin, being they sold black wool, right? White garments for me, so you will not be shamed by your nakedness. And ointment, and here that's what they made. And ointment for your eyes, so you will be able to see. I correct and I discipline everyone I love. So be diligent and turn from your indifference. Wow. That's kind of messed up, right? I'll get to those next verses in just a second. Church of Laodicea receives no affirmation, just like Sardis, none. No affirmation, just correction. See, the problem with Laodicea was that they had material abundance, but they also had spiritual poverty. It's amazing how sometimes those are found in the same place. That we will have material abundance and yet spiritual poverty. The warning maybe to us is, be careful, because our prosperity may blind us. But here's the thing. This next verse, I want to read these next couple of verses just because I know you've heard these before. Right? Right? Uncle Billy Joe or Aunt Sally Mae or whatever, somebody's got one of these pictures hanging somewhere. And so out of context, you have always heard this. Verse 20. Let me read this to you. This is it right here with the church of Laodicea in their warning. Look, I stand at the door and knock. If you hear my voice and open the door, I will come in and we will share a meal together as friends. Wait a minute. We've all seen it, right? The Jesus knocking at the door thing, no handle on the door, right? We've all seen it. And we've always been told what? That's a salvation verse. That's about your salvation. Jesus is standing at the door of your heart and knocking. And if you'll just let him in, he'll come and sup with you. Have we not heard that? That's not the application. That's not the context. I mean, you could go ahead and use that if that makes you feel good. It's all right. And a lot of people came to Christ through that. That's good. But that's not what it was about. That wasn't a door to your heart, my heart, any individual person's heart. It was a door to the Laodicean church. He didn't break away from the context of speaking to this church all of a sudden to minister to your heart. Bless your heart. In the middle of this message, he's trying to warn this church that you think that you've got it all. You think you're wealthy. You think you're rich. You think you've got all this stuff, and you are poor, miserable, naked, and blind. Why? They had shut Jesus out of the church. They had become so self-sufficient, they didn't need him anymore. And he's not going to barge through, kick down the door. Right? That's what we want. We want it to be irresistible so I don't have any responsibility. Go see Oprah for that stuff. That's not in here. Jesus, this is a revelation from him, about him. So I don't think he got it wrong. He characterizes himself as being persistent, realizing the church has shut him out. He He's not barging his way in, but he is not giving up. And he will continue to pursue us, and he will continue to pursue that church. He will continue to knock on the door of that church, wanting the door to open so that the presence of Christ can be in the church. We've taken the presence of Christ out of the church. And I mean in a lot of different ways. Oh, I know all the things you do. You hear that phrase over and over again? There's a lot of churches that got all kinds of programs that are helping all kinds of people. That's wonderful. You don't need Jesus or the Holy Spirit to do that. We got a whole generation of people who are activists. They are not Christians. But we need to be helping. Yeah, well, that's true. But you can help all those people without Jesus. He's talking to the church. He's saying, some of you need to stop the crap you're doing and come back to me. See, we can shut Jesus out so quickly and maybe the most unpredictable ways. We sang about it this morning. What was it in Oceans? We sang that song at the end where it talked about my faith would be made stronger. How? In the presence of my Savior. We desperately need the presence of Christ in the midst of the church. We don't want to be that church. See, I was always taught, and probably a lot of you heard it too, you know, this whole hot, cold, lukewarm thing. The hot was good. Man, if you're on hot, you're on fire for God. And if you're cold, you're just turned off. You're rejecting of God. And so we somehow bought into and believe that as long as I'm hot, God likes it, or if I'm cold. So that means if I'm on fire for Christ, God likes it, or if I'm against him, he likes it. That's theologically retarded. No, hot is good. And cold is good. And the people who got this message understood it. Hot meant that you were like the hot springs of Hierapolis and that you brought healing to people around you. Cold meant like you were the cold water of Colossae and that you brought refreshment, invigoration, and life to people around you. But what Laodicea would really identify with, but no, you're lukewarm. Ugh. And good for nothing. And he's saying, I wish you were one or the other. I wish you were having a healing effect on the world around you, or I wish you were bringing refreshment to the world around you. But you're neither. It's good for nothing. That's challenging. So he says in verse 21, those who are victorious, who are the victorious? Those who are what? They're faithful because they're
listening.
Thank the Lord, somebody's listening. Those who are victorious will sit with me on my throne, just as I was victorious and sat with my Father on his throne. Folks, we hear the victorious, and that's good. But I want us to make sure we don't go, because we have a tendency today to think that it's all about walking in victory. Walking in victory, right? But if we make that the forefront, walking in victory, that becomes about us. And then we begin to measure it about me. Whether I'm victorious today or how well I'm doing or well I'm not. No, no, no. It's about walking in obedience. Victory is a byproduct of walking in obedience. And see, obedience is about God. Now he becomes the center of attention. Victory, it becomes all about me, whether I'm in victory today or not, whether I'm experiencing the joy of the Lord or not, whether I'm right. Really? How about you walk in obedience and let him dictate whether the joy of the Lord's coming your way and not whether you're having a good day or not? I don't know if you knew that. Did you know that God was the same on your good days and your bad days? Did you know you're just as much a sinner on your good days as your bad days? Did you know that you could be just as saved on your good days as you are on your bad days? Because it's about him and not about you. So here's my questions again. One more time, and we'll get out of here. Are we asleep? In what ways have you and I, become careless or apathetic in our walk with Christ? Right? Are we like the Church of Sardis? The Church of Sardis, one thing uncommon with the other churches before it that were reprimanded. There's no mention of persecution. I don't know if you knew that. No mention of persecution for Sardis or Laodicea. They didn't need persecution. They lacked it, and it was killing them. They were doing themselves in because they were compromising. What's our temperature? Using the metaphor of water, how would we characterize our effect on the world out there? Are we hot? Are we bringing healing to people? Are we cold? Are we refreshing, invigorating? Are we lukewarm? Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for the word. I thank you for this revelation. I thank you for this message, this warning, this challenge that you delivered to these first century churches, Lord. Lord, I'm grateful for the examples that some of them present as not having it all together and having a lot going wrong. Makes me feel that I'm not all alone in that. Lord, I also thank you for those that are the examples of those who were doing it right and how they were being faithful in the midst of challenges. Lord, I'm grateful that no matter what was going on, no matter how bad your warning against the church, you still gave hope to those who would listen to your warning, who would heed your warning, to those who would walk in obedience, they would experience victory. Lord, I pray that those things from the message to these churches that we need to apply to ourselves, to our congregation, to our body of believers, Lord. May we be willing to hear. May we be willing to listen. Never shut your presence out of the church. Lord, I pray that what it is that draws us here on Sunday mornings, Lord, I pray ultimately we come to a place that what draws us to be at this place is not the pastor's message, not the praise team's music, not even seeing my friends and family, but it is the presence of Christ in this place that draws us. Lord, I pray that we would be so infused with that presence that we would carry it out of this building and into every place that we go. Lord, may we carry your presence into our neighborhoods, into our homes, into our workplace. And may we be hot water healing to people. May we be cold water, refreshing, renewal, invigoration to people. Lord, your word says that you discipline those who you love. Lord, I'm sure they were feeling the love. May we not forget that. Lord, when we experience the hand of your discipline, may we realize that you love us. You love us. And you only desire our best. You want to see us grow. You want to see us groomed and shaped. Become more and more like your Son. So Lord, I pray this morning, we as a congregation, we as a body, as a community of faith, that we would submit ourselves to that process. In Jesus' name.